sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Have been given materials about this case, including the briefs, and they may have heard from lawyers and others discussing the briefs. I've now introduced you all to the court, so let me introduce the court to you. On my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. To his right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on the far right is Justice David Prosser. With these introductions made, I'm going to call the second case, which is versus Vorburger, and we'll hear you first from the Assistant Attorney General, Stephen Kleinmeier. Mr. Kleinmeier.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Stephen Kleinmeier, representing the state of Wisconsin, which in this case is the plaintiff, respondent, petitioner. This case is here on the state's petition for review of the decision of the Court of Appeals that reversed Mr. Vorburger's conviction. The Court of Appeals found that that the trial court should have suppressed evidence that was seized in the search of the apartment he shared with Amory Becker. The apartment was searched after Ms. Becker gave her consent to search the apartment. The reason for reversing the conviction was that the court found that Ms. Becker had been illegally arrested at the time she gave the consent, therefore the evidence should have been suppressed. The court also suppressed evidence seized in the search of a car, which was based on Mr. Vorburger's consent. The state has not petitioned for review as to that part of the decision. Now, the two main issues for the court are, one, whether, so we're only dealing with the consent given by Ms. Becker, whether she was detained pursuant to a Terry stop or whether she was arrested when she gave the consent to search the apartment. And the second issue is whether the consent was, if the court finds that she was properly detained, legally detained, then the question becomes whether her consent was voluntary. Now, the state's position is at the time she gave the consent, she was still being detained pursuant to a Terry stop, for which supported by reasonable suspicion that it had not ripened into an arrest at that point. Mr. Vorburger's claim is that due to the length of the time Ms. Becker was detained and the conditions under which she was contained, by the time she gave the consent, it had become an arrest. In agreeing with Mr. Vorburger, the Court of Appeals cited several factors which it said made this into an arrest rather than a Terry stop. Among those were the fact that Miranda warnings were given, there was handcuffing, these various suspects were separated, Ms. Becker was interviewed in a separate room, there was the ratio of police officers and suspects, and the police refusal to permit Ms. Becker to go to a bathroom in privacy. And the court also questioned why Ms. Becker was questioned after the motel room was searched. Now, this is a situation where, kind of in the middle of the day's events, the police had this hotel room staked out waiting for a search warrant, and they saw Mr. Kramer, who was registered to the room, coming down the hallway with Mr. Vorburger and Ms. Becker. As he was putting a key in the door, the police came out of an adjoining room, detained all three, put them in handcuffs, separated them in the hallway, frisked them, put them in handcuffs, separated them in the hallway, and then waited for the search warrant to arrive. And three people were stopped at, I believe it was 9:20 p.m., the search warrant arrived at 10:05 p.m. The warrant was read to Mr. Kramer, whose room was going to be searched at 10:15. The officers went into the room a couple minutes later to do the search. They found some of some marijuana there and I think some other things. And apparently about 10:30, the detective who had gotten the search warrant, Detective Olson, came out of the room, conferred with another officer there, Sergeant, I think it was a Sergeant Gaber. They then talked to Officer Kosovac, a female officer, who then, I believe was probably 10:39, took Ms. Becker into an adjoining room. The room that was searched was room 231. I think she took her into room 230, Apparently searched room 230. I believe she took her into room 231. As soon as going into the room, she took off her hand, Ms. Becker's handcuffs, let her use the restroom, although the officer was present at that time. And then the officer gave Ms. Becker a drink and said, told her that the police were investigating or conducting a drug investigation, and asked her if she'd mind staying or if she'd be willing to answer questions. This was after Miranda warnings were given also at this point.
Is custody the same as arrest?
I think most of the time the term is used that way. I think the word custody, the way it comes up, can sometimes be kind of ambiguous. But in terms of the tests that are used here, which comes out of the Swanson case, which talks about when this person's in custody, and especially the fact that test comes out of Miranda cases, where custody means custodial interrogation, arrest. I think
that's what I'm asking.
Yes, I equate the word custody with arrest.
And detention, under Terry, is not an arrest.
Correct.
And not custody, and you don't have to give Miranda.
Correct.
Okay, just clarifying.
Here they talk about detention, and is that what you just asked?
Yeah, I guess I'm equating the word detention with a Terry stop situation.
Right.
And custody with arrest.
And your position is this is detention.
Continuing.
How long was the detention?
These people were originally stopped. These three people were originally stopped at 9:20. She was taken in the room at 10:39. It's exactly how long that interview lasted, and exactly when she gave the consent, it's not clear. But apparently, about 11:15.
Okay, so from 9:20 to 11:15.
Yes.
And she's questioned during detention, not during custody. That's your position. It has to be your position.
Yes, that's correct.
And then the fact that the officers gave her the Miranda, they just did that as protective. They didn't have to do it. Is that right?
Correct. And actually, there's a couple places in the record where Officer Monty, another was Sergeant Braber, gave her, explain why they give Miranda. They said just to be safe. They said if they think it's getting close to a situation, I think it was Officer Monty said, if we're getting close to a situation. It's Officer Monty, which should be in document 58, page 274, saying often we will read their Miranda warnings before they're under arrest, before we even know or think they're going to arrest them, but just when there's a situation that may reach that standard where a reasonable person may start to think that they are under arrest. So I think it is a situation of the officers being cautious. And
she couldn't leave, though.
No, that's a detention. A person who is the detention is a seizure, and a person's not free to leave during a seizure. It's a different degree of seizure, a different kind of seizure from an arrest, but they're both seizures. There's no question about that.
Mr. Clyde-Meyer, when the questioning started around 10:39 p.m. Was the search of the other room still occurring?
Actually, the record's not clear exactly when the search ended. The search started at 10:17 is when the officers went into the room. About 10:30, Officer Olson came out, said when she came out, she left Officers Paulson and Linsmeyer in charge of the evidence collection, which certainly indicates officers were still in there doing more searching. Well, Detective Olson came out. Detective Olson came out, conferred with Sergeant Gaber for a couple minutes, then asked Officer Kosovac to question or to talk to Ms. Becker. And the other next time is 10:39 when it says Officer Kosovac and Ms. Becker went into room 231. So there's no more reference as to how long that search continued or whether it continued or how long it continued in room 230 after Detective Olson came out.
Is that significant at all in regard to the issue of detention versus arrest?
I don't think so, especially under the Fountain case that we have cited. It makes sense that the officers are going to wait. They're going to wait until after they at least start the search or find something in the room, see what they're dealing with in the room before they start questioning suspects. I think an argument was made that basically if they stopped at 9:20, why weren't they questioned then? police had heard from the motel manager who had been in the room that there was marijuana in there. Therefore, since they knew there was marijuana, he had taken a sample out. That was all the police needed to question the suspects. But I think it would be pretty poor police work to start questioning suspects about something in a room when we don't know for sure yet what's in that room. You have some idea what might be there, but that could be just a small amount of what's there. Much other evidence in there that you'd want to question. And the Fountain case is the one where this same issue was raised, where the police officers came to execute the search at Fountain's residence, and they came with at least three other people there. Mr. McKeedy was the key one we're talking about now. He was just a visitor. He was not a resident. Police came, handcuffed everyone, executed the search, which took 30 to 60 minutes. After the search was over, they took them one by one into an adjoining room and then questioned the people, and they did this to Mr. McKeedy. When the search was over, they took him into an adjoining room, questioned him for a couple minutes, and he said he had contact with weapons there. So then they conducted a longer search later. And the court, he challenged the fact that he was questioned after the search warrant was executed. And the court said, well, that's the way it's done, because that's when the police, at that point, after they know it's completed the search and know it's there, this is when they then talk to the individual to dispel or confirm the reasonable suspicion, or give the individual a chance to explain, offer an explanation they want to give. But it's after the search and after they know what the evidence is that they're dealing with.
Counsel, I have looked at the MacArthur case, because that's such a recent U.S. Supreme Court case. As I read MacArthur, that issue was whether you could keep people out of the home, that is, keep the resident out of the home, and whether you could do that pending getting a search warrant.
Right.
I do not read it as directly relating to this case, because in this case, the issue was not whether it was lawful or reasonable for them, for the officers, to keep all these people out of room 230. The issue in this case is detaining the individuals. In MacArthur, they just said you can't go there. They didn't tell him that he had to stay near the trailer or near the home.
Well, first of all, I certainly agree that MacArthur is not direct precedent for this. I think there are some principles in MacArthur that are applicable here, though. The primary one is it's a reasonable test that's applied.
But you're drawing that out from a search of a home and restricting people from going into the house. You're drawing those to a detention of the individuals. There was no detention of the individual in MacArthur.
Well, it was termed a temporary seizure.
Of the house.
Of MacArthur.
But they did not, that is of keeping him out of the house.
Well, he was limited in his movement, and the court termed it a temporary seizure. And, you know, analyzed it under the terms of Terry and Michigan versus Summers and these other Terry-type cases. And they also, I think, and what I think is also significant there, another point there that's applicable here is the court, in analyzing this as a temporary seizure, and being reasonable, said that 2 hours was not an unreasonable time to wait for a search warrant. And they distinguished the Place case, which Mr. Vorberger relies on, they distinguished Place, which was a 90-minute wait, by saying the problem in there was the police that did not diligently pursue the resolution of the issue. And they said here they were diligently pursuing obtaining the search warrant. In that context, 2 hours was not too long to wait. So, I mean, that I think that's a point that's applicable, I believe, in this case, and that here the wait for the search warrant was about 45 minutes the search warrant arrived. But, I mean, the main principle, I think, is so that the time itself, just the fact it's 45 minutes or even almost 2 hours from the point of initial stop from Ms. Becker until she gave consent, is not necessarily too long for a stop, as long as the police are diligently pursuing resolution of finding out, dispelling their suspicions. So, I mean, I think those are the reasonableness aspect, and I mean, that's, I think, the primary application MacArthur has here. And, I mean, it does, again, verify or affirm that a person can be seized awaiting a search warrant. and which was, of course, here. I mean, they were waited, they were seized before, I mean, they were held for 45 minutes before the search warrant showed up. I think I'd like to provide a little, go back into a little bit of back. I mean, in this case, this is one of those cases where sometimes I'm here and the facts are 2 minutes and that's it. The facts here are pretty significant. I'd try to summarize them. But I mean, remember, at 2:30, Mr. Kramer registered for the room. At about 4:30, the manager goes in, finds some sampling of marijuana and calls the police. The police then come and almost immediately set in motion the process of getting a search warrant and stake out the room. And then I think it was 5:45, Mr. Kokoris shows up and starts to insert a key in the room. His connection is that when Kramer registered for the room, the license number he gave for a car went to Kokoris's car. And Kokoris's excuse for showing up for the room was, well, I was going my way back to La Crosse, Eau Claire, and I just stopped to use the bathroom. However, it also turns out that Mr. Kokoris had the previous night registered in room 215. He checked out that morning, and then Mr. Kramer checks into room 230 the next day using the license plate for Kokoris's car. And the police, there's some officers here who explain. I think Officer Gaber is the primary one, and it also appears in the search warrant affidavit, explaining that these are circumstances that are indicative of drug trafficking. The fact that there's more than one person, they're shifting rooms, that they're using the same license plate. So, I mean, there's a pretty good idea that not only is there some marijuana in there, but it's being used as part of drug trafficking. Also, the clerk who registered Mr. Kramer at 2:30 said there were two other people in the car. She did say that the other people in the car did not match Mr. Vorberger's description. But so we have a third person out here somewhere at the time of the registration. And then with that, I mean, there's probably more, but that is the background. And then at 9:20, Mr. Kramer shows up with Mr. Vorberger and Ms. Becker with him. And the police had seen, from Kokoris, they had already identified what Kramer's car was. So officers saw Kramer's car pull in the lot, Mr. Vorberger's car come in with it. Mr. Kramer stopped at the hotel office to pick up a key because he was missing his since Kokoris had it. The two cars stopped. Mr. Kramer went in and got the key, came out. Both cars, as the officer said, drove in tandem around to the entrance to the motel room, and the three people were seen entering the hotel together and then walking down the hall together. So I think with that background, there's certainly reasonable suspicion to believe that Mr. Vorberger and Ms. Becker are about to commit a crime involving the contents of that room. So that gives a reasonable suspicion for the detention. And then that, again, under Felton, they could wait until they could be questioned about that after the search was completed.
Mr. Kleinmeier, you both touch upon Michigan versus Summers in your brief, your arguments. And it's my understanding that you get into a bit of a dichotomy over whether or not Becker and Vorberger are occupants of the room. As you know, in Michigan versus Summers, the discussion has to do with occupants. What's your position in that regard?
Okay, well, first of all, I think it's probably not necessary to even reach that issue in this case, in the sense that it's all these facts or the facts that have gone through, I think, provide the reasonable suspicion specifically as to Vorberger and Becker. And based on that suspicion, these people could be held. Michigan versus Summers set up what they admitted was a blanket rule that when they come, they can detain any occupant on the premises. They didn't define occupant. At least one of the cases we have cited said, thought that was significant, that it wasn't defined as its owner. And we've cited some cases. The Fulton case was one again, and Pace, I believe, was another one. Pace, Taylor, Andre, and Phipps, which applied this to anyone on the premises, applied Michigan versus Summers to anyone on the premises when the police showed up with a warrant. And especially as I think it's the United States versus Pace, at 1239 points out, when they first come, the police can't even be sure who the occupants are at that point.
So your definition would be not, your definition is anyone who's on the premises, regardless of the connections that they have with the premises.
That's right. On the basis of the cases we cite, anybody on the premises when the police show up to do the search, yes. And here, I think, even though this was a little bit before the search when these people showed up, I mean, the police were in the process of getting the warrant, and I think there already was they were about to be admitted. The officer said that the officers in the adjoining room said Mr. Kramer had stuck the key in the door at the time the police came out. So, I mean,
your analysis does not require any consideration then of the connection she had with the premises, significant or otherwise.
No, just the fact that she'd be present when they searched for the search warrant. But again, as I said, this case is probably not, I don't think it's really necessary to get there because Michigan versus Summers is a basis for detaining the people during the search. And I think our first argument is since they're separate, in this case, reasonable suspicion. I mean, this is not a situation like some of the cases we have cited, like Fountain and Pace, where the police just show up with a warrant and the other individuals are in the house. And at that point, the police don't have any specific information about those individuals other than their presence in the house. I think here, in this case, looking at the background, what's going on with this hotel room for a few hours before this happened, and the fact that these two people arrived with Mr. Kramer, provides reasonable suspicion, even to hold them totally apart from Michigan versus Summers. This is a separate justification than reasonable suspicion.
Your position is that if there's a probable cause to get a search warrant for a premises, that anyone who tries to enter those premises can be detained.
Normally the situation is the person would be on the premises when the police arrive. And I think in this case, we have a situation where they were about to be admitted by the occupant of the room, by the person who registered the room, so I think it's basically the same in this case, yes.
It would be different than if just a bystander, somebody just walks into the situation. Here, you seem to be saying there has to be some connection. These three people were walking together from the vehicle.
Well, I think the fact they were walking together and came in together shows, I mean, the fact that their cars arrived together and that they came in together shows that it was just not a matter of pure coincidence that those two happened to be in the hallway as Mr. Kramer was about.
Counsel, in response to my question, your answer, I heard you to say, maybe I heard it incorrectly, was that in your analysis, the contacts, significant or otherwise, that the person has with the premises are irrelevant. That's what I heard you to say. Now, maybe I misunderstood you.
Well, you said
being on the premises is all it takes. You don't consider the contact significant or otherwise.
Yes, those are situations where when the police arrive with a warrant, the people are already in the room. In this case, I was just showing that making the connection that their connection, the connection of these two people and Kramer is significant because they, at this point, they were stopped when they were still outside the room. I mean, I just wanted to make the distinction between wanted to show that there was a connection between these two people and Mr. Kramer in this case, even though outside the room, to distinguish it from a situation where Mr. Kramer would be about to insert the key in the door and these two other people, as a matter of pure coincidence, happening walking down the hallway and be near him at the point the police came out of the room. And I think that's why in this particular case, since they're still outside the room, it's important that we can show that there is the connection, that they came into the room together, and that Mr. Kramer was about to admit them into the room. And the fact that he's about to admit them into the room was another point, it's related to another point made in the Pace case, where when the police arrived, actually it was to arrive to execute a search warrant for gambling, and Mr. Pace and another individual, I think like Bassace, were in there. They were not residents, but they were in there, and when the police executed the search, they found money lying around, a large amount of money and drugs, and they thought it was significant that even if the people didn't live there, that the resident would let them in the house with all this drugs and money around to show a close connection. And that's why the reason the Pace case gave for applying Michigan versus Summers, I think that's applicable here, where the police found that there was a large amount of marijuana, and it was open enough that when the hotel manager went in, he smelled it right away and had no difficulty finding it. So the fact that Mr. Kramer was about to admit these people to his room, I think also shows a connection, that they were involved with these drugs.
Could I ask?
Your argument has to be that you can only detain people that you have a reasonable suspicion is connected with the commission of a crime. Is this a Terry stop?
Yes.
Well, the crime is drug dealing, right?
Right.
So you can detain anyone that is, you have a reasonable suspicion that's connected with drug dealing. Could you detain the owner of the motel when you have no reasonable suspicion that he's at all connected?
Okay, well, I guess I'm not disagreeing, but I guess I'm not quite sure the context you mean here. I mean, are you talking about the people, are we talking about people just in the room when the search warrant arrives, or?
No, these people are outside the room.
Okay.
And you're detaining them. Isn't that your question, Justice Bradley? They're detaining them.
Okay.
You know, you have to have reasonable suspicion to detain them, don't you?
Yes, and I'm arguing, well, I normally do it, I'm arguing this case they did. I said, the argument would be that if you're going to apply under Michigan versus Summers, where you could detain occupants, even without separate reasonable suspicion as that individual, I think it would fit here in that Mr. Kramer was about to admit them, and they arrived with him. He was about to admit them.
So you don't have to have reasonable suspicion?
Yeah, not under that theory. And that's kind of a secondary position. I'm trying to separate the two because our initial position is there was, under the more traditional analysis, there was reasonable suspicion to detain them because of, again, the background that's going on with this room that day. They arrived with him. That provides a reasonable suspicion.
Could I ask, was Becker's status exactly the same from the time that her handcuffs were placed on her until the time that she gave consent to search her apartment?
Her status as being detained as opposed to arrested, yes. That's our position. Is that what you mean by status as opposed? I guess I'm not. I mean, our position is she was detained as a Terry stop for which you only need reasonable suspicion from the time she was initially stopped in the hallway through the consent. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, though.
Well, near the end, she wasn't handcuffed. Search was over. She was given Miranda warnings. I mean, was hers?
She was still seized because she was not free to leave. And that's the key. I mean, I think she was a seizure, and the seizure, we think, her argument is, it was the level of detention as opposed to rising to an arrest. That even though the handcuffs were removed, she still remained detained, and that the Miranda warnings themselves did not turn it into an arrest. It was really caution on the part of the police. I cut the red light. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. You have 5 minutes. Mr. Cook, representing Bradley J. Vorberger.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Dave Cook, and I represent Mr. Vorberger in this case. The question of an arrest here, there's an objective test. Whether or not a reasonable person in Ms. Becker's position would believe that she's in custody. And that test comes out of the Swanson case. Swanson was a traffic stop. And in Swanson, the state argued that Swanson was arrested. He was not handcuffed. He was not told that he was not free to leave. There was not an extended time period involved. And he was not given Miranda warnings. And yet the state said Mr. Swanson was under arrest. Contrast that with this case where the state is saying that Ms. Becker was not arrested. She was handcuffed for over an hour And then she was taken into a closed room in the motel where her handcuffs were removed, but she was in a closed room. She was not allowed to use the bathroom in privacy. She was given Miranda warnings. This lasted for the total amount of this detention until the alleged consent was given, lasted over 2 hours or almost 2 hours. And I think most importantly, there was 45 minutes to an hour of continued detention after the search warrant was executed. And after the detective went into that room, made notations of what evidence was in the room, came out of the room, consulted with Sergeant Gaber as to what the next best plan of action is, and then they decided to begin interviewing the suspects.
Mr. Cook, when we look at the Swanson case, Swanson also says, does it not, that one of the factors to look at in determining whether or not there's been an arrest is what the officers communicate, either by their words or by their actions, to the suspect. Now, it's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in this particular case, the officers told Ms. Becker, and apparently she was told a couple of times, that she was not under arrest, that she was being detained because they were investigating whether or not there was a drug crime and were waiting for a search warrant. Is that not correct?
That is correct.
Is that not significant?
Well, it's not that significant because both of those officers who testified to that said that they informed her of that immediately after she was handcuffed. In other words, right at the very beginning of this two-hour period. And it may very well be that at that point she wasn't under arrest. She was just being detained. They had reasonable suspicion. But what we have in this case is what is her situation 2 hours later after that handcuffing has continued?
Well, at what point do you think there was an arrest?
I think what's really critical here is, was she under arrest at the point when the consent to search her home was given? And definitely at that point she was under arrest.
Why? What changed from the time she's initially detained until the time she gives consent that changes it from detention to arrest?
Well, you have, first of all, the passage of time. You have the Florida v. Royer case, where you have a 15-minute detention in a closed-off room in an airport, invalidated the consent to search a suitcase in a drug case.
But you also have the MacArthur case from this past term, where 2 hours is okay.
Well, MacArthur was quite a bit different because, first of all, MacArthur owned the home, and there was a two-hour detention while they obtained a warrant. But MacArthur was not handcuffed. In fact, he was allowed to enter the home while under observation. They were concerned that he might destroy the drugs that they had probable cause to search his home for. But he was allowed to enter the home. He made phone calls. He could obtain cigarettes. And most importantly, when they finally executed the warrant, they found the drugs and they arrested him. In this case, after they executed the warrant, they found absolutely nothing that connected Becker or Vorbrugger to that motel room, and yet the detention continued beyond that for an additional 45 minutes. In other words, here, the execution of the warrant dispelled the suspicions. There were suspicions that somehow Vorbrugger and Becker were connected to this room, but once they execute the warrant, there's nothing there. There's nothing that can connect them to that room, and at that point, they should have been released.
Well, an associate of theirs was connected to the room, wasn't it?
There was a man who they came to that motel room with, but there is nothing connecting Becker or Vorbrugger, and certainly just associating, the Supreme Court has decided that just mere association with a drug suspect is not grounds for detention.
If there were some sort of incident in the courtroom here,
where someone in the audience got up and shot the marshal. And the police came and asked, and in fact expected, demanded that everyone who witnessed this stay here. Would they be under arrest? Stay here in order to say what they saw and know about the crime. These people be under arrest?
I don't believe a reasonable person in that position would believe that they were in custody. Now, if everyone in the courtroom
would they be free to leave? Would they be free to say to the officers, "We're out of here. We're not going to talk to you"?
They probably would not be free to leave, and they would be detained. But would they reasonably believe that they were in custody? I don't think so at that point. If they were handcuffed, if they were held here for 2 hours, at some point, people are going to believe that they are in custody. If they are under those circumstances, if they're handcuffed, if they're interviewed by the police and the police find absolutely nothing, no information of value, or get all the information as to what they witnessed, find out that they have nothing connecting them to that event, and they're still not released after the interview is completed and after nothing is connecting them to, in other words, once the need to detain them is gone, to interview them to find out what happened, if they're still held in custody and they're still in handcuffs, yes, at that point I think a reasonable person would
say they're in this case, a search warrant had been executed, drugs had been found, a crime had been committed, and it was after that that consent was given by a person who had knowledge, could have had knowledge about the crime, was no longer handcuffed, had been permitted to go to the bathroom, and was talking with, was it a woman officer, or at least an officer, and said, "Yeah, you can open my purse, yeah, you can go to my apartment." That person under arrest?
I believe so. The fact that the handcuffs were taken off is not that significant. In fact, I think the Court of Appeals found that the actual level of scrutiny was heightened by the fact that they took her into a closed-off motel room. She was still unable to leave. She was in the presence of an officer all the time. She was not being questioned about any connection she had to what was found in room 230. This became generally a wide-open search for crime unrelated to room 230, and that's what makes this unlawful, because the request for consents was asking for consent to search her home. There was no connection for a need to search her home with anything that was found in room 230. The police already knew that marijuana was in room 230 before they executed the search warrant. And then after they executed it, they had no additional evidence or information at all than what they already knew beforehand. And so at that point, there was no need to further detain two people who had no connection whatever to that room, had never been in it. And that's what really, and that's another point of distinction here, as between the cases like Pace and Fountain and Michigan v. Summers, where you're talking about occupants or people who are actually in the dwelling that is being searched. In this case, neither Becker nor Vorberger they certainly were not inside the room at the point where they were detained, which is a significant factor in Michigan v. Summers, because what the concern about detaining someone who's actually in the room that's being searched is that person is in a position where they can disrupt the search. They can destroy evidence. They can make the search more difficult. They may be a danger to the police. Here you have the detention is occurring for people who are outside of the room that's to be searched or premises to be searched.
In Pace...
Mr. Cook, do you think that's really that significant a distinction? My understanding of the facts is the key's in the door. The key is being turned. They're standing right next to Mr. Kramer. They're about to enter the room. Do you think that that's really so significant a difference, whether they've stepped over the threshold or are still outside waiting to enter?
Well, the court's concern in Michigan v. Summers was where it was talking about the detention of occupants but not owners. And the concern there was that these people are actually in the space that's being searched. So I think from that standpoint, that is quite a significant distinction, because here the people were actually not in that space that's to be searched. They were held outside.
Well, isn't the detention tied also to the idea of concern for flight and also concern for the safety of the officers?
Yes.
Don't you have the same concerns whether they've stepped over the threshold or not?
Yes, those concerns would theoretically be present in the case of detention of someone who's not actually in the house. But it's very important in this case, and this goes to the fact that these people were handcuffed. Mr. Vorberger, throughout that two-hour time period, and Ms. Becker for about an hour and 15 minutes of that, there is absolutely no evidence at all in the record that would suggest that there was any lack of cooperation among the suspects. There was no evidence of concern about flight. In fact, one of the officers recognized Mr. Vorberger by name. She had seen him as an employee of a club in Madison. There was no concern about guns, nothing articulated by any of the officers that had any concern at all for their personal safety. This was not a crime of violence. There was no reports of violence associated with this. So in those kinds of circumstances, to put handcuffs on a person and then to leave them on for this extended period of time, I think, is a very significant factor in transforming what may have begun as a detention into an arrest. Certainly a reasonable person who is handcuffed in that situation for that length of time with no justification for the handcuffs would believe that they are under arrest. The length of time is an important factor here, and it's important that the U.S. Supreme Court has been very careful about limiting the duration of a Terry stop. The initial case, Florida v. Royer, that stop was a detention of 15 minutes, and the court said, no, that was transformed into an arrest after just 15 minutes. Then you have the Sharp case, and all of these cases are after Michigan v. Summers. You have the Sharp case where you have a traffic stop detention that lasted 40 minutes. And the issue in that case was, should the 20-minute limit on a Terry stop that is set forth in the Model Code of Pre-Arraignment Procedure, should that be a constitutional rule? And in Sharp, the court said, well, no. And in this case, 40 minutes is okay, but only because the length of that detention was extended by the defendant's own actions. In other words, it was the defendant's actions in not stopping immediately that prolonged the time length of the detention. So 40 minutes was upheld, but only for that reason. And then in the Place case, you have a 90-minute detention, again in a drug case at an airport. And the 90-minute detention is held to be an arrest. It's an unreasonable detention because the police could have obtained their warrant. They could have done, they knew when this flight was coming in. They could have obtained their warrant. They could have proceeded with more diligence, and the 90-minute detention was unlawful.
Can you explain what your view is of what the police ought to have done with Becker and Warburg?
I believe that As soon as the search warrant was executed and Detective Olson came out of that room and consulted with Gaber and said, this is what we have found, I think perhaps there could have been, if there could have been some questioning as to either Becker or Warburger at that point, if they had any connection to what was found. But Olson already concluded when she came out of there that there was nothing found that was that connected those two to the room or to its contents. And at that point, they should have been told that they're free to go. Now, it's possible that action should have been taken even earlier in this case because, and that's the open question as to whether or not you can detain suspects while handcuffed for a period in excess of an hour while you're obtaining a search warrant. That hasn't been resolved, and it's very possible that they should have been released sooner. These are not occupants. They're not owners. They could have been questioned about what the police already knew about what was in room 230, and at that point, if there was no connection established, released. But the court doesn't have to answer that question because under the facts of this case, we've got a much more extensive period of detention, and most importantly, we've got detention after the execution of the warrant should have served to dispel any suspicions.
I'm not quite clear on your position that the execution of the search warrant dispelled any suspicions that Becker and Warburger were involved in drug dealing. I read the inferences exactly the opposite. What the execution of the search warrant revealed was that there was a drug dealing operation going on in this hotel room, and that would enhance their suspicions that if they're showing up there with the guy who leased the hotel room, they're involved in a drug dealing operation in some way, perhaps as persons lower on the food chain, and they've got to further investigate by seeking consent to search their persons and their purses and their apartments and their cars. Why are those inferences not reasonable to continue the reasonable suspicion that was mentioned?
Well, I think
Because they didn't find some document in the hotel room with their name on it linking them to the hotel room does nothing to dispel suspicions. What they found was a large amount of marijuana, something like 14 pounds, and a digital scale, which are, that's indicia of dealing, not just mere possession that they were arriving for a party. They're there as part of a drug deal. Being admitted to the room by the person who leased the room, giving rise to the inference that they're part of this operation. They're not just there for a visit. Right? Isn't that a reasonable inference?
I don't think so. I think, and the Court of Appeals concluded the other way also, saying that the police already knew that marijuana was in that room.
Right. They didn't know the extent to which there was marijuana evidence in the room. They knew there was marijuana evidence. But once they go in with the search warrant, they found out that it's a lot.
Well,
and then further, in addition to a lot of marijuana, there's indicia of dealing. Why wouldn't that solidify or help solidify their suspicions rather than dispel them?
Because there was nothing connecting either Warburger or Becker to that room, other than the fact that they came there in separate vehicles following Kramer.
Let's deal in reality here. I mean, people involved in the drug dealing chain of distribution don't typically leave calling cards, right? I mean, they've showed up with the man who leased the room, and the police found a large amount of marijuana and indicia of drug dealing once the search warrant was executed. So the fact that they didn't find anything else affirmatively linking them to the leasing of that room doesn't do anything to dispel suspicions.
I think at some point, if they're going to arrest, if they're going to, they they have to have more than just what's found in that room.
Why?
And they know that, which is why they continued their investigation.
Well, let's put it a different way. Birds of a feather flock together. So if you're associating with a drug dealer, there's either reasonable suspicion that you're a buyer or a seller or user. And or you can say, you can't, reasonable suspicion is not enough, but why can't you, you don't need much of a probable cause, right?
But you do need more than just mere association with the...
Well, that's the question, do you? I mean, I think that's the question that Justice Sykes may be posing to you. It's not only that they're walking down the street together, that's association. And the cases generally say just associating with a criminal is not enough to be probable cause that you're a criminal, right? I mean, that's the general rule.
Yes.
Okay, but we're not just walking down the street. We are going into the den of iniquity together. We're going into that motel room. And it's not to watch TV. Why isn't it probable cause to think that they're there to buy drugs, sell drugs, or use the drugs?
That's the suspicion, yes, and that's all it is a suspicion. But
that's sufficient to sustain the temporary detention for as long as it takes to dispel the suspicion. I mean, if this is a Terry stop, the police are entitled to detain these people to dispel their suspicions that they're part of this drug dealing operation, right? And the execution of the search warrant did not dispel those suspicions. More was required. They were entitled to continue to investigate, to read them their Miranda rights, and ask them questions about their movements during that day, where they have been, question them further about their associations with Kramer, I guess, who's the guy who leased the hotel room, and try to get them to consent to further searches. What's wrong with that? That's good police work.
Well, I think when a person has been handcuffed for this length of time, and when the search is executed and it doesn't provide, you can say it didn't dispel suspicions, but it didn't add to any suspicions either. And
so what?
And I think the Court of Appeals point was that because it didn't add to anything that was already known before that point, it can be viewed as dispelling suspicions because you're not going to get anything more out of that search that links these people to that room.
Why can't you continue questioning? That's, I think, what Justice Sykes is saying. You, there's obviously suspicion they're tied in with the guy who's selling out of this motel, or at least is a seller. So now you got reasonable suspicion. So you say, can we search your car? Guy says, no. Can they search the car?
Not if he does not consent.
Because there's no probable cause.
That's correct. Right?
Okay. Then we say, can I search your house? Person says, no. Can they search the house?
No.
No. Because there's no probable cause. So how long can they keep them there until they break down to, and I don't mean that it's not voluntary, although I know that's one of your arguments. How long can they keep them and question them so they dispel suspicion? 1 hour? 2 hours? 5 hours?
Well, under Florida v. Royer, 15 minutes is too long. And that's the law of the U.S. Supreme Court.
That's your position, then. Once they didn't tie him up with that search warrant for probable cause, it was only a limited time that they could keep him.
Their time...
detention.
In fact, their time may have run out even before that. You don't have to address that in this case. Here we have detention that lasted almost an hour beyond the execution of the warrant. And at some point during that time, a reasonable person would believe that I'm in custody here. I am not just being detained. I'm actually in custody. The police are reading me my Miranda rights. I've been handcuffed for 2 hours. They're questioning me. I am not free to go. They've told me I'm not free to go. I am, in fact, under arrest, and a reasonable person would believe that, certainly, in this situation. If they hadn't been handcuffed, it may have changed the balance of that. If the time had been shorter, and you have the execution of a warrant within 20 minutes that turns up nothing more, as in this case, that would change the analysis, too. If they were in the room as opposed to outside of the room, that would change the analysis,
but
too.
Isn't it the law that the police are entitled to use handcuffs during a temporary detention for questioning a Terry stop without transforming that Terry stop into an arrest?
There are cases, and the Court of Appeals acknowledges, there are cases where the courts have said it is appropriate. But in all of those cases, there certainly is no blanket rule that you can handcuff suspects in a Terry stop, even in a drug case.
Well, the Fountain case that was discussed by Mr. Kleinmeier specifically indicates that, does it not? That you could use handcuffs and that is not dispositive on whether or not there's been an arrest.
Yes, and the cases that have addressed handcuffs have always said that there has to be some articulated justification for the handcuffs. In other words, a concern about flight, a concern about weapons, which were present in the Fountain case, concern about a crime of violence, concern about destruction of evidence, which was also a concern in the Fountain case. Here, none of those concerns were present.
Or interfere with the police search.
Yes, interfering with the search.
But aren't you handcuffing the cops?
I don't believe so at all here. I think what you're telling the police is that the police need to know when they can use handcuffs to detain in the process of detaining suspects. And what they need to be told is when you have an articulable reason for doing so, because if you're concerned about flight, you're concerned about lack of cooperation, you're concerned about guns or violence, then you can do it, at least temporarily, until those concerns are dispelled. But they also need to be told, and this is a case where they could be told that, is that you cannot just do that when you have no reason for doing that, and you cannot leave those cuffs on for an extended period of time like this, because then the detention is transformed into an arrest. There are limits on how long and when the police can use handcuffs in a Terry stop, and that's what this case presents.
Didn't they have concerns here, first of all, in regard to flight, but also in regard to their own safety? And didn't they ultimately remove the handcuffs from Ms. Becker? When they questioned her and when she gave her consent, she wasn't handcuffed.
They did take her handcuffs off after she was taken into a closed room, yes. They did not remove Mr. Vorberger's handcuffs at all, and before he consented. I see my yellow lights on, and I do want to make one other point, and that is that the state has not pursued the Court of Appeals decision as it relates to Mr. Vorberger's consent. And the result of that consent was the search of his vehicle, which led to the finding of a small amount of marijuana, but that was one of his criminal charges. And so that evidence and the suppression of that evidence has been ordered, the Court of Appeals has ordered that there be a remand for that evidence to be suppressed. Now that particular charge, there were five counts in this case, that was one of those five counts. And it was part of a global plea agreement, and that particular count was dismissed, but it was used as a read-in for sentencing in Mr. Vorberger's case. So I guess my point here is that even if the court were to rule different than the Court of Appeals as to Becker's consent, the judgment in this case still has to be reversed and remanded back to the trial court for suppression of the evidence that was found as a result of Vorberger's consent, because the state is not challenging the Court of Appeals ruling as to the lawfulness of Vorberger's arrest and the validity of his consent that led to the evidence that was seized out of his vehicle.
That's only one charge. That's only one of the charges.
That is, yes, that is one of those charges.
Did the trial judge put any emphasis on that read-in charge at the time of sentencing? There was a 30-month sentence here, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Did the trial judge put any emphasis on that particular count that had been dismissed at the time of sentencing?
I'm not aware that anything specifically was said in the record as to that read-in, but the court was certainly, it was a read-in, was entitled to consider that in fashioning the entire sentence, because that was the purpose of the read-ins. There were actually four read-ins in the case, and so I think it's reasonable to assume that, yes, that was considered by the judge in fashioning the sentence here.
What would it be remanded for?
I believe it would be remanded for suppression of the evidence as to that count, and then there would the plea, which was negotiated with that count as part of it, would be undone, and then the case would proceed either to trial or to a new plea. If the court reverses the Court of Appeals in this case as to the evidence relating to Becker's consent.
I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're suggesting. You're saying because the count on the marijuana found in the car, which was dismissed anyway?
The state has not challenged the Court of Appeals order remanding the case for suppression of the evidence found as a result of that consent. And so...
But that's not a count that there was a conviction on, so why does it matter at
all? Because that count was part of an entire plea agreement, and that count was dismissed, but as a read-in to be considered by the court in imposing sentence. It was part of the total picture that Mr. Vorberger was looking at in determining this case came very close to going to trial, and it was part of the total picture that Mr. Vorberger had to consider in deciding whether to go to trial or to accept the plea agreement. And so if you take that count out, it alters that picture. It alters the decision-making process as to the plea, and it also alters the sentencing situation because the case was dismissed as a read-in, and so the court was allowed to consider that.
Was that a misdemeanor marijuana possession count?
I believe it was possession of marijuana, a misdemeanor, yes.
Which is a 30-day misdemeanor, right?
I'm not sure what the total exposure on that.
Perhaps as much as 6 months, but I guess what you're suggesting is the whole plea deal would have fallen apart, but for this misdemeanor marijuana charge, or the whole plea deal would have been different?
I'm saying that Mr. Vorberger's consideration of his situation, yes, would have been different in the absence of that count.
What was his exposure on the other counts?
I believe it was 15 years on the major felony count.
So a misdemeanor marijuana charge, whether it's 30 days or 6 months, I just don't remember. Probably wouldn't have made a big difference in reality.
It may not. And we don't know if it made a difference in terms of the court's disposition here, too. But we are left with this situation where the Court of Appeals has ordered that the evidence that was seized pursuant to Mr. Vorberger's consent must be suppressed.
Why was the Court of Appeals suppressing evidence on a dismissed charge? I don't get that. I guess I'm not following this procedurally.
Well, the charge was dismissed, as part of the plea agreement. And so, obviously the suppression issues were preserved before the plea agreement.
And so
if the count was dismissed, I don't get why anybody cares about the suppression of the evidence on that count. And I'm sorry I'm prolonging this, but I'm trying to clarify what your position is about the case having to be reversed and remanded anyway, or remanded anyway. I don't understand that.
I think the significance is that you have one count. It's not the most serious count, but it is one count that was part of the total picture in making the plea decision. And you also have that count, and the read-in is considered as an admission. So the court is allowed to consider that in imposing sentence. So even though it's not a major part of the plea agreement, it is part of the picture there that went into the plea decision, and it's also to some extent part of the court's decision in imposing sentence, and that's why it's significant. We don't know to what extent that played a factor either in Mr. Vorberger's decision or in the court's ultimate disposition. We can only speculate about that.
Thank you, Ms. Justice Sykes. Is that sufficient? It'll have to be. Thank you, Attorney Cook. Attorney Kleinmeier?
I want to address the point about how long Ms. Becker was held after the search warrant was executed and whether that was too lengthy.
Counsel, before you do that, would you just, do you agree with your opposing counsel with regard to this one issue and the remand that's necessary that the state didn't challenge at the Court of Appeals ordered it and has to be remanded? Do you agree or disagree?
I disagree on the remand. I think under the Tony Armstrong, T.O. and I, Armstrong we cited in our reply brief, under that case was similar to this one in Armstrong where there had been a plea bargain, I believe, and some of the counts were reversed. And this court, however, affirmed, I think on the rationale that when you consider the whole thing, the count that gets suppressed would not have affected the overall plea bargain, and I think that's the situation here.
Did the state challenge, by not challenging that part of the Court of Appeals opinion, do you have a problem?
In problem in what regard, I guess, is... by not challenging, of course, we're bound by the finding that that head count gets reversed. Under the Armstrong case, if one count of a multiple count bargain that results in one conviction gets reversed, the appellate court can look at it and judge whether that one count would have made a difference in the person entering the plea. In this case, given the counts that were the five charges and the small, I don't want to say more insignificant, but the small penalty would have faced on this one, I don't think that if that's eliminated from the overall plea bargain process, if we back up and say, okay, that's no longer part of the plea bargain. We're looking at four counts, and we're bargaining four counts instead of five. I don't think that would have, the court can draw the conclusion, I think that would not have affected the decision to enter the plea. And on that ground, affirm the conviction as stands. Otherwise, it goes back. Obviously, I want to get into, just trying to be brief, the length of Ms. Becker's detention after the search warrant and during the questioning. And I think what happened is during the questioning, things got added on. And instead of dispelling suspicion was added by this. But the officer started out by saying that, telling Ms. Becker they were conducting a drug investigation and asked her if she wanted to talk about the day's activity. No, this is in document 59. Should start at page 197. It's Officer Kosovac's testimony. She's the officer who interviewed Becker. She starts out by saying that she said she wanted to ask Becker if she'd talk about her day's activities. It led to the point where the police contacted you at the hotel. And so then Becker started describing this, and during the course of the day, she said she and Vorberger shared a blunt around 5:30, and she talks about her marijuana use, and then mentions that they met Kramer. Kramer went somewhere to try and pick up a key, couldn't find the key. Then they went to the hotel. She talks about using marijuana. The officer asks if she could check her purse. Becker gives consent to search the purse and then says, "But there's nothing there, but I have some back in my my room, and then they took me back at the apartment, and it goes on to the apartment. So during this interview, I think instead of eliminating any concern about the connection to this room, to the marijuana in that room, it increased it, because these are people, Becker admits, uses marijuana. This is a person who uses marijuana. She's showing up, she and Vorberger are showing up at a room with Kramer, which is part of a drug dealing operation, especially in light of the police experience, and when these people are changing rooms daily and changing registration names and so forth. So I think that instead of dispelling any suspicion, it really increased during the course of that interview. And one point I want to make, which I hope doesn't have to be addressed in the court decision, but in case it does, before the time runs out, is if the court affirms the Court of Appeals and finds that what the police did here was wrong, please provide some guidance as to how to do it right. I mean, we have a situation where the Court of Appeals said, throws up about six or seven factors and says, detention illegal or illegal arrest. But if police are confronted with a similar situation again, they would have no guidance on how to do it right. But I think what they did was right as it was. Another point is the time that Becker was held in handcuffs. And I think there was a concern for safety. I mean, you had three, this was not, especially since it was not an individual suspect, there were three suspects. And I realized there were multiple police officers in the hotel that night. But they couldn't always provide undivided attention to these people. There were other tasks to be performed. And if they were, the people aren't handcuffed, they don't have to overpower five or six police officers at once. If they are able to overpower one police officer and get that officer's gun, there could be a problem. So I think, especially the fact that there's multiple people in a drug situation, a drug search warrant, was a basis to justify using the handcuffs. So time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. Thank you, Mr. Cook, for your arguments. That concludes our hearing on 00-00971.